Okay. All right, I think we're all set. Hello, everybody. I'm Alex Tabarrok. I am the Director of Research for the Independent Institute. The Independent Institute, for those of you who don't know us, is a nonpartisan public policy research organization. Every year, we publish many books. We publish a quarterly journal, The Independent Review. And we host forums like this one, both here and at our offices in Oakland, California. Our goal is to enlighten the public and to better improve public debate and understanding of social and economic issues. Before we get to our main event, I did just want to make a note. I wanted to congratulate Mario Vargas Llosa on winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. Aside from the obvious merits of this pick, The War of the End of the World is certainly one of my favorite novels of all time. Aside from the obvious merits, this is important to us at the Independent Institute for two reasons. First of all, Mario has a deep understanding of the foundations of a free society. He is a classical liberal and a true scholar of what makes civil society possible. In addition, Mario is the father of Alvaro Vargas Llosa, who works here at the Independent Institute. He is the author of many Independent Institute books, including this one of Liberty for Latin America. And he's generally an all-around great guy. He is busy fielding telephone calls at his home today, but he'll be back in the office tomorrow. So we're really very excited about this award. Okay. Today's forum. Today's forum is about an unusual topic. A number of people have made the argument that the environmental movement has aspects of a religion to it. Michael Crichton, the novelist, once said that the environmental movement, it's got a lost Eden, a state of grace, when we had unity with nature. It then has a fall from grace into a state of both literal and figurative pollution. And of course, this pollution was caused by a result of the eating from the tree of knowledge. And of course, the environmental movement has a judgment day, which is coming for all of us. Now, often critiques like this are made from the perspective of economics, which is a seemingly rationalistic and secular alternative to environmentalism. But our first speaker today, Robert Nelson, challenges this conventional perspective. Economics, argues Nelson, also has theological presuppositions about the nature of the good. Now, being an economist myself, I don't always agree with Bob's arguments, but they do sometimes make me a little bit uncomfortable. For example, for somebody who thinks of himself, as I do, as a secular thinker, it can be a little disconcerting to find that I am often preaching the power of the invisible hand. So Bob may have me to rights on that issue. That's right. There's certainly some connection there. Bob is a professor at the University of Maryland. He is the author of The New Holy Wars: Environmental Religion versus Economic Religion versus Environmental Religion in Contemporary America. This really is a superb book. It challenges both sides of the debate. And I'm also very pleased to note that The Holy Wars was recently awarded the 2010 Eric Hoffer Grand Prize Award. Hoffer, for those of you who don't know, was the longshoreman philosopher whose book, The True Believers, remains a classic in the study of religion and of mass movements. Bob is joined here today with two scholars who have thought deeply and critically about the nature of economics and religion. Stephen Hayward is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he writes regularly about economics and the environment. He is also an accomplished historian, and I would mention in particular his magnificent two-volume history, The Age of Reagan. We're also fortunate to have Max Stackhouse with us. Max is professor emeritus at the Princeton Theological Seminary, and he is the general editor of the four-volume God and Globalization series. In particular, is the author of the fourth volume, which lays out what has been called a moral infrastructure for a worldwide civil society. So we're going to begin tonight with Bob Nelson, followed by Steve Hayward and Max Stackhouse, and then there'll be an opportunity both for questions and debate among our panel, and also for questions and debate and answers from our audience as well. Bob.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Alex. So far, you're fitting my model, which is that when I tell an economist that environmentalism is a religion, they all say, well, yeah, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. But they're all, they recognize there's sadly some truth, but they're all very nervous with the idea that economics is a religion. It works the other way. If I tell an environmentalist that economics is a religion, oh, it's a no-brainer. I mean, any number of environmentalists that I've dealt with said, oh, yeah, it's obvious. And some of them, they didn't realize that I was saying the same thing about environmentalism. So they came in for a shock maybe a few months later after they had endorsed my book and then discovered all the nasty things that I had said about well, they weren't necessarily nasty. When I talk about religion, some people use it as a pejorative word. It's not a pejorative word for me. It's just a factual word, so to speak. In fact, I actually believe that everybody has a religion. I have one, too. It's sometimes hard for me to figure out. So it's really a question. Unlike most people and most social scientists, I actually, believe we can discuss religion. And we don't have to have a holy wars all the time, although it seems like we somehow end up with them disconcertingly frequently. The other thing I'll say is that this project, and it is a project, I mean, I've been engaged in it now for 20 years, looking at both economics and environmentalism as religions. It started out, and it continues to have a very practical purpose, which is to understand the world. And I find that I can't understand the world and what's happening unless I incorporate a large religious element. I thought I'd just give a little example. This is just, I see hundreds of these examples every year. Well, maybe not every year, but dozens every year, maybe hundreds, maybe even hundreds. This is from the New York Times just the last few days. It's an article called Green But Still Feeling Guilty. And it's about a Colorado couple. I'm going to read from the article briefly. It's about their practices. It goes on, the renovated stairway is made from reclaimed barn wood. Their furniture is also made from recycled wood and steel. In fact, the coffee table is wood that was reclaimed twice, having been salvaged from reclaimed wood that was being made into flooring. They use only natural cleaning products and are constantly drinking out of their Brita pitcher, so there's no need for disposable water bottles. All their personal care products are organic, and Mr. Dorfman's clothes are made from organic cotton and recycled materials. But then they confess that they like disposable diapers and haven't been able to get over them. And this, though, has provoked a feeling, as they put it, not only do I feel guilt, I feel hypocritical. Now, I submit there's no way, I mean, this is not practically, a set of practical measures to protect or preserve the environment in any way that anyone, that reasonably could understand them. This is a set of religious rituals. It's, to me anyway, it seems transparently obvious. I think anyone else. Now, it raises the question, though, what's the religion? So you have a lot of articles like this, but you don't have very many people who say, what's the religion? And where do these religion, where do these rituals derive? What are the implicit kind of faith beliefs that lead you to feel that these, doing all these recycling and other things make you a morally better person? and make you feel righteous or make you feel hypocritical when you violate one of these beliefs. And so that's kind of what the project is about on the environmental side. I think economists, they don't have as many rituals like this, but they have other characteristics that can't be explained by normal, conventional, rational analysis. And I will say, and again, as has already been mentioned, it's a somewhat unusual book, or maybe very unusual book. In fact, it doesn't seem to have any followers, which is a problem that I have. And because there's always somebody who's nervous about this religious side, because most people are either economists or environmentalists. And if they're a little bit concerned that if they get in on the take here, the fire might be returned at them. And then how are they going to deal with it? But anyway, I was at the Interior Department, actually. So this whole project actually came out of very practical experience. I worked in the Interior Department 18 years, from 1975 to 1993. And during that time, I observed the policymaking process. I was in the Office of the Secretary. It was a very interesting experience. But one of the things that I noticed is it didn't fit any of the models that I was used to. Or that they had taught me in graduate school, or that I was reading about in books that were derived from social science. You know, it wasn't maximizing economic benefits. It wasn't even, a conflict of interest. Actually, it was a value struggle, you know, where what the Interior Department was doing was, you know, taking actions that were symbolically defining what American values were. And that had more to do with a lot of the policy making in the department, especially things like wilderness or rangeland, which were low value, than any normal economic or political considerations. And gradually it dawned on me 30 years ago that this was really religion. And so I didn't do anything about it for quite a while. I was a little intimidated to write about it myself. And but eventually I got up my courage and wrote a book, and so here I am. But anyway, the purpose of the whole thing was really, in some sense, to understand, and I claim, although I'm an expert in the Interior Department, but I claim that the more I looked around other areas of American policymaking, the more I felt that in these areas as well, we were looking at fundamental value conflicts that people were uncomfortable with. It. They didn't want to be seeming to be fighting about religion in public. So they essentially masked all their value convictions under a pseudoscientific, superficial presentation. But if you actually probed a little bit beneath the scientific explanations they offered, you basically found a religion. But they didn't want to call it a religion, so they had to offer all these disguises. So the book, The New Holy Wars, is kind of like, trying to reveal the emperor's, real appearance without all the superficial clothes. And that's kind of what I've been doing, is saying, well, what are the people, if you get rid of this, what do they really believe? And so it's also, as I was saying, partly a reflection on the fact that, I basically felt that a lot of the models that I was using weren't able to explain the world. And so this led to the, various books and so forth. Now, getting to economics, in what sense what am I saying if I say economics is a religion? Now, some people say, oh, well, you just mean this metaphorically, or you just like to be provocative, and you hope you'll sell more books if you call it a religion. But maybe that's in my subconscious, I don't know, but that's not what I think I'm doing. I mean it literally, that economics is a religion. And in what sense? Okay, well, basically it derives from the fact that a faith in economic progress, I would say, has been a dominant religion of the 20th century. And believing that basically economic progress can save the world and make for a vastly better place, lead ultimately to heaven on earth if we actually perfect the economic system. I argue, and I don't have time to go through all the people who've said these things, but if you read the book, you can find a number of examples that this has been, you know, pervasive as a belief throughout at least the last 150 years. If you believe, though, that economic progress can save the world, what will your priesthood be? Well, it'll be the people who know about how to achieve economic progress. That is to say, your priesthood will be economists. So what will economists do? Their efforts will be dedicated to revealing the true workings of the economy and thus the path of maximal economic growth. And if you believe this will save the world, then economic knowledge is your new Bible, so to speak. The place where you go to learn how to perfect things. And when I talk about perfection through progress, it's moral perfection as well as material perfection. Okay, now what about environmentalism? Well, it's not exactly a social science, but it's factually in a lot of ways similar to economics. It has a different set of high priests. They're biologists and ecologists. They also claim a scientific status, and beneath that lies all these moral presuppositions. So environmentalism, like economics, is also a project of social change. It's a project at improving and ideally perfecting the earth. It has its own moral standards, and in many other ways, it functions like a secular religion. So they're both religions. However, they have very different perceptions of the world. For example, this is obviously a critical one, of the relationship of humans and nature in very different terms and with all kinds of policy implications. For economists, nature is, quote, we call it a natural resource. That means something we use to produce more, to increase human welfare for the benefit of the economy, and it's essentially seen in a utilitarian sense. But for environmentalists, maybe not all, and I need to say that environmentalism is diverse, and some people would say that Resources for the Future, which is an organization dominated by economists, is an environmental organization. They're pretty much exempt from everything I'm saying here. They're actually believers in economic religion, but who want to move economic religion to take better account of environmental amenities. And so there are people like that, actually maybe quite a few. But what I would, when you get to the distinctive contribution that environmentalism has made to contemporary debate, where they're introducing really new ideas and new values, or as I would say, a new religion, one of the main areas is this issue of how do we relate to nature. And for environmentalists, nature has intrinsic value, and that is it's outside human benefit. So we don't have to establish human benefits in order to value or protect or want to do good things for nature. Or nature is the scene, and the word the creation is used throughout environmental discussions, as a place where we can go to learn. Now, the environmentalists don't always say God, but what they really mean is learned about the mind of God as it was manifested in the creation. God's not in the creation, that would be pantheism, but the creation was a product of divine design. And so this, if you think of things this way, it's going to be an immensely spiritual experience. You go into the wilderness, what are you doing? You're actually encountering something created and designed by God, and as a reflection of the mind of God, you're learning about God. And this is a very old way of thinking of things in Christianity. It goes back more than 1,000 years. In fact, throughout the history of Christianity, they've talked about two ways of actually directly learning from God about the world. One is by reading the book of the Bible, which is a divine, direct divine revelation, but the other is by going into nature. And especially until the modern era, people believed that nature was pretty much the original creation and it hadn't been changed much. And so it was seen as a revelation of God's thinking. Now, of course, we know now, or you know, that we have Darwin and all these other things, but I claim that really when environmentalists go to the wilderness, they're still perceiving and experiencing the wilderness in this classical Christian way. Although they would probably, they would be confused, actually. If you asked an environmentalist, why are you so spiritually affected by the wilderness? If you're a Darwinian scientist and all the rest of it, they really wouldn't be able to answer the question. I claim or argue in the book and go to great lengths. I describe something in several chapters which I call environmental creationism. And this is something that's definitely not going to go over very well with the environmental community. But I argue there that there are actually rather surprising affinities and connections between the way environmentalists see nature and the way Christian creationists see nature. And that is, they both see it as essentially, you know, directly a product of God's work. And so I would argue that a lot of evolutionary biologists and so forth, who also are deeply spiritual environmentalists, are suffering from a kind of an internal schizophrenia, and that they don't know how to exactly resolve. So anyway, this conflict, which manifests in itself in lots of other ways, can often become embittered. It's a remarkable how much difficulty economists and environmentalists have talking to each other. How much even hatred they feel for each other at times. And it's like heretics or sinners in each other's presence. There's even an environmental philosopher who wrote an article in a quite respectable environmental journal called Why Environmentalists Should Hate Mainstream Economists. And that was the title of the article. And this is a professor at Georgia Tech or something, in the philosophy department or something, one of those Georgia institutions. And so we get then a whole host of tensions and conflicts. I might mention that we have, for example, when it comes to something like what are the symbolic, what are the cathedrals of the religion? And this is something I write about in the book. And I would say that when people in the 20th century, especially the middle of the earlier, or the first half of the 20th century, visited a dam, people would go, I call them economic pilgrims, and they would go to a dam, and how would they perceive it? They would perceive it in quasi-religious, or actually I would say really religious terms. It was a symbol of progress. The dam was controlling nature, a raging river, for the purpose of generating power, creating water for irrigation, controlling flooding, providing all these benefits, which were all symbols of progress. And when I worked at the Interior Department, they had a lot of paint murals that had been painted in the 30s as part of the job generation, and they were like, The big symbols of the painting were often a large dam, and in the Soviet Union, actually, it's kind of remarkable, they had dams too. In fact, before we were in a space war, we were in a dam war with the Soviet Union, none of the dams actually were that much good, or not none of them, but a lot of them were actually a waste of money, but they were fulfilled a spiritual symbolic need on both continents. So what's happened to the view of a dam? Well, David Brower, who was for many years the head of the Sierra Club, is one of the leading environmentalists of the the second half of the 20th century, he said, I hate all dams, period. So why? Well, for him, the dam symbolized the same thing, which is human control over nature. But for him, that was evil. And for him, it was, you know, nature was innocent, and we had defiled it and we had erased a part of God's creation, if you want to put it maybe in a more theological way. So it was an evil thing to do. And on the other hand, what are the cathedrals of environmentalism? Well, they're wilderness areas. And so what characterizes a wilderness area? Basically, it's the minimal amount of human places that have had the least amount of human contact. So you're kind of, you know, your most worshipped sites are defined by the absence of a human presence. And we see this for also, it's not just wilderness areas, but let's say the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which has obviously become a huge symbol for the environmental movement. How is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge characterized? It's characterized as one of the last untouched places on the Earth. So it's the absence of human impact which allows us to go there and see the creation in its original form, or at least you might be able to imagine it that way. It's probably not true, but you don't have to put... it's easy to get into the mood of thinking of it that way. That's one of the many differences. So it's essentially you're seeing... in some sense, and just to wrap it up, I had a lot more here, but I'm condensing it very rapidly as we're going along. I'm not good at time management, but I do know that I'm getting to the end. But it's a lot of it. I mean, at some fundamental level, it's kind of a verdict on what you might call the modern project of rationally directed economic progress, organization of society to maximize production and economic welfare, but not just because you like economic welfare. It represents a conviction that the real source of evil and sin in the world has been material scarcity. I mean, you see this in extreme form in Marxism. So it's economic deprivation or desperation, and that's what drives people to do bad things. So if you have that diagnosis for the presence of sin in the world, then you have a fairly straightforward route of salvation. Basically, you eliminate economic scarcity, which is what Marxism was all about. And he thought capitalism was actually necessary because it would lead to the elimination of scarcity, and that would be heaven on earth. So you move along an economic path. You reject other explanations. What would be other explanations of evil in the world? One would be the fall in the Garden of Eden. Well, that's just an old myth. you can reject that one. A more tempting one might be a genetic explanation. People are evil because of their genes. That one is obviously fraught with danger. So people are not really going to go for that. And what's left, basically, that people are shaped by their exterior environments, these environments. The most important part of it is economics. If you want to perfect the world, you perfect the economic environment. So what does environmentalism say? It says that's all wrong. It's actually, we were much better off before all of this. So what did modern efficiency get us? Well, it got us the Holocaust, for example, which was old-fashioned anti-Semitism married to modern economic efficiency. It got us atom bombs, and we might kill ourselves in the end. And so the modern project of progress, now even economists have more doubts about it, but that basically is the object of environmental criticism, and you can see this with Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, which was the seminal book starting the environmental movement. I mean, until that, or in the 50s, DDT had been considered a miracle drug of modern chemistry. And Rachel Carson came along and said, no, it's not true. All these modern chemicals and so forth are actually doing terrible things. We've worshipped progress, but it's blinded us to all the negative sides, and in fact, a lot of the negative sides are terrible, and we have to get off this kick. And so that's where environmentalism has been coming from. And if you have these different perspectives, and now a lot of people mix them together in their own practical day-to-day thinking, but if you go to the priests who actually take them the full logic of these things, you get completely clashing views of the world and about what we should be doing in public policy in places like the Interior Department. And so in the Interior Department, if it's economic religion, we want to maximize progress in natural resources. If it's environmental religion, we want to protect nature from all these bad things that human beings have been doing, which is, we know we can't get rid of all civilization, but we could try to minimize it and restore it. So restoration, since we've already ruined so much of it, restoration is one of the main parts of the environmental agenda. Okay, I went over a little bit, but not too bad. Okay.
Stephen Hayward. Well, first of all, congratulations, Bob, on an extraordinary book. And I'm going to spend my time sort of explaining why that congratulations needs to be underscored and given exclamation points and so forth, because the richness and complexity of this book has compelled me to do something that I never like to do. And that is that I'm completely in a state of chaos as to how to comment on it. And so, I mean, I've got this sort of mess of notes here. I mean, I hate doing that because there's huge risk when that happens. But I do remember reading one of Robert's early books on this subject, Reaching for Heaven on Earth, The Theological Meaning of Economics, almost 20 years ago. And I remember reviewing it at the time and thinking, I'm not quite sure he's right about a lot of things in this book, but boy, he's onto something really interesting. And so, I mean, I'm not sure I can make this comparison at the Independent Institute, but, you know, if you think about early Marx and late Marx, well, this is... Reaching for Heaven on Earth was early Nelson, and this is late Nelson, the sort of full-blown Nelson in full. Well, right. Let me see if I can bring some order to my chaos, like God and creation, in the following way. When I think about the subject of environmentalism as religion, I'm reminded of a time I was in London, you know, 15 years ago or more, and flipping around the telly and catching one of those classic British comedy sketches. It's one of their sort of the runners, they call it, the comedy business. It's the talk show where the guest was the Lord Jesus Christ, who'd returned for the second coming. And you have that BBC host saying, well, tonight our guest is the Lord Jesus Christ. He's back after 2,000 years away. And, you know, and welcome, Mr. Christ. And he says to him, so, you know, a few of the little banter says, I suppose you'll be back to doing your usual miracles, you know, healing the sick and the lame and, you know, turning water into wine and such. And Jesus says, oh, yes, I assume so. Of course, within the limits of sustainable development. Now, there's a bit of an ambiguity in that sketch. What exactly is being made fun of there? Is it religion, which is what British comedy sketches are usually making fun of, or is it environmentalism, or is it both? Or is not there at a deeper level in a way that comedy often catches better than philosophy or social criticism? Is there not catching the denigration of religion overall? I think that joke works for both sides of Robert's analysis here. Because, you know, Robert's first book sent me back to something that I sort of arrested me once 30 years ago now. It was a special issue of The Public Interest in 1980, where Irving Kristol wrote, and I'll quote him, "Theology has practically ceased to be a respectable form of intellectual activity." Now, the context for this was a special issue of The Public Interest about the crisis in economic theory. You know, cast your mind back to 1980. Everything wasn't working. The doctrine of economic progress had smashed against the wall. Keynesianism doesn't work. We were stuck with stagflation and all the rest of that. You might say we're in a similar situation today with the whole matter turned inside out, deflation instead of inflation, right? But our economists are, we don't have a lot of stock in them right now, do we? We sort of lost that confidence. But obviously the unstated premise of both the comedy sketch or Irving Pristol's remark is that, you know, religion is not quite respectable. Why not? Well, that's not mysterious subject. One of the things that Roberts explained in several of his works, including this one, is the rise of economics as the technical deliverer of the idea of progress arises out of the whole Enlightenment project's faith that material forces would replace natural or divine law, that faith in progress replaces faith in providence, and economists replace the priests. And I think he was right to say that economics takes on a form of religion, at least insofar as reason requires, sort of the, you know, reason with a capital R, requires perhaps as much of a leap of faith as religion does. I mean, this is something the postmodernists are onto. I mean, I sort of dislike postmodernism, but I think it's not an accident that the postmodern skepticism about the idea of progress really began to gain traction at exactly the moment economics began to run into trouble in the late 1960s. I think that's roughly right. And Robert repeats a lot of great quotes from, among others, Keynes. Keynes talking about how economic controversies, quote, resemble medieval disputations at their worst. So, you know, I think Robert has done something that almost nobody ever does. You know, usually when you say to environmentalists, well, you know, environmentalism is a religion, they take it as an insult. And usually, by the way, a lot of people who say that mean it as an insult or denigration, right? A lot of critics do. And what Robert's done is taken them seriously, or taken the phenomenon seriously. A lot of environmentalists will say, no, I'm science-based. I'm interested in science. And they'll resist what you're saying about that it's a religious creed. Although a few, of course, will readily admit it. And there have been a lot of, a lot of environmentalists who have embraced religion and religious analogies. And so I guess you might say, by the way, that environmentalism, like Christianity, has a lot of diversity in it. How many kinds of Lutherans do we have? I've lost count. There are a lot of different kinds of environmentalists. And I think, by the way, it's sometimes a mistake to say the environmental movement or all environmentalists think X, when in fact there really is a range. There are some commonalities to all of them, just as the commonality of Christianity is the divinity of Christ and the basics of the creed, but then along the way you have all kinds of differences in styles of worship and emphasis and styles of baptism and so forth. Well, environmentalists are like that too, and I think we make a mistake, both critics of environmentalism, which I am a lot of the time, and friends and people in between, in not paying attention to the distinctions that are to be made out there. And one of them is between environmentalists who would make a wholesale rejection of a religious character to environmentalism because they share the premise, sort of Enlightenment premise, that religion is not quite respectable, and then those environmentalists who are actually open to it, the ones who do talk, as Robert said, about places like Anwar as being a sacred space in the fullness of that meaning. Well, there's a couple of ways to slice this up, it seems to me, in addition to the way that Robert has done it. Another way I sometimes have analyzed environmentalism, and especially I thought this about Al Gore's famous first book, The Earth and the Balance, is that it reminds me a lot on a purely secular level of Martin Heidegger's famous argument that technology has separated mankind from nature, and it's alienated us from nature. This is sort of a premise of existentialism. And if you go back and read, I'm not sure it's any better in the original German, but which I don't read, but in translation it's very difficult. But if you read Heidegger's essay on technology, he talks about how, written in the early 50s, we rip coal out of the ground and burn it and throw pollution up into the air. And he's suggesting that this is, he doesn't quite use this word, but it's unnatural in a certain way. And you can see a lot of environmental themes there that make their reappearance really quite dramatically, I think, in Gore's book and in other... And of course, he's an atheist. And he's skeptical of reason, too. But very late in his life, if you know the story of Heidegger, a year or two before he died, he gave an interview where he said, we've reached such a desperate position of man being separated from nature that only a God can save us. So he was open to a religious answer to this problem if you can understand him at all, which is problematic, but I think this is interesting stuff. Now, Bob raised the point that I often talk about environmentalist hostility to economics. You know, you mentioned David Brower, who was often called, I think, in that famous biography of him by John McPhee, the archdruid of environmentalism. You know, a pagan term, right? Well, I don't know if you remember this, Bob, and I've got the slide I should share with you. He took out a full-page ad in the New York Times in 1993. Now, what a full-page ad, so that was like a $50,000 ad in 1993. The headline of the ad was, "Economics is a form of brain damage." QED, right? And, you know, this thing was going on to say, you know, please, President Clinton, don't listen to these maniacs who want you to apply cost-benefit tests to regulation. Okay. The year before that, at the Rio Earth Summit, Hazel Henderson, a fairly famous activist of her time, said, come the eco-revolution, we're going to round up economists and send them to re-education camps. So I want to say that I actually think that the real conflict... I think, by the way, environmentalists have sort of gotten over that to some extent. My observation is very few mainstream environmentalists, or whatever term you want to use, would say that kind of thing today. They more openly embrace, especially in this climate issue, the importance of economics and thinking through at least policy choices, although I often find their grasp of economics to be at about the kindergarten level. But that's another story for another day. I think at the end of the day, there's a much deeper conflict between conventional environmentalism or religious environmentalism and Christianity. And Bob hinted at a couple of the problems here, and I just want to deepen them a little bit, and then I'll stop. Bob pointed at some of the similarities. You can make out similarities between the creation story, man being thrown out of the Garden of Eden for its sin, which can find its rough parallel today, I suppose, the Industrial Revolution, or any number of other ways you can think about it. But, you know, just as it's possible to make out Marxism as a Christian heresy, it seems to me that environmental religion, in the main features that Bob has pointed out, is also a Christian heresy. For one thing, Bob mentioned this, but just to reemphasize this point, there is a completely different view from Christianity in the place of humankind in the hierarchy of nature. And let me restate that and say, environmental religion essentially denies that there is a hierarchy of nature. There is really nothing distinctive about the human species over the other animals, so they would reject the idea that's explicit in Genesis of man's dominion over nature and responsibility of stewardship over nature. It may not be formally egalitarian, but here and there, people will point to environmentalists who say things like, these quotes are famous, right? The person who says something like, you know, if it's a contest between a bear and a human being, I'm not sure who I'd root for. Or the government biologist who wrote that article in the Los Angeles Times in 1989, I think, reviewing Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, where he said, the mankind is a plague on the planet comment, and, you know, until we change our fundamental nature as a species, we can only hope for the right virus to come along, you know, to thin us out. That comes to side in the worst expressions of environmental religion, this hostility to humanity, or if not hostility, at least a rejection of the idea that human beings have an exalted place below the angels but above the animals and beasts of the field that is explicit in Christian theology. That makes the two doctrines or the two religious approaches to thinking about our planet and creation fundamentally irreconcilable, I would suggest. It seems to me that's a harder conflict than the one between economics and environmentalism. Because as I say, I see some progress in environmentalists, baby steps at least, in understanding economics as a tool they need to use. Because what is economics study? Resources, as you were saying. I'll just add this observation. Oh, I've gone too long anyway. You mentioned resources for the future, and this is slightly off the topic. But, you know, Resources for the Future was founded by one of the original doomsayers of environmentalism, Fairfield Osborne, in the late 1940s. He wrote a book called Our Plundered Planet, which was one of the first in that whole genre of we're all doomed. And so what's kind of interesting is Resources for the Future ended up as a bunch of economists, very much in the center of the political spectrum, resented by the doomsayers. I mean, you know, if you talk to a lot of environmentalists, they don't like Resources of the Future very much because they're those grubby economists who tell us that things that cost more than the benefits they deliver are not worth doing, and they hate hearing that because that crosses your theological imperative. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Zach. Well, I concur that this is in a magnificent volume, and it's very interesting reading, and I hope you all get copies. I've just done my Christmas shopping, and I've got gifts for some of my best friends who are economists and ecologists, and it's this book. But what I want to do is outline the way I read it as a theologian, and the thing I like about it is the multiple levels that it covers. You could begin by saying at one superficial level is this book challenges the conflict between the producers and the protectors. The producers and the perfectors is protectors. Is that better? Okay. And the producers, of course, want to transform natural resources and to meet human needs and wants. They want to overcome poverty. And today, everyone talks about poverty. Economists historically have talked about scarcity. It's the same problem. And attribute all sorts of evil to scarcity. I'm reminded of Bernstein's West Side Story, where Officer Krupke, you know the song, and Krupke says, "What are you guys doing here, this gang, and what's the matter with you?" And he says, "I'm depraved on account of I'm deprived." And that's the account that many people give to the evils of the world. But some of the people who are working in the production side are actually attempt to provide jobs and fund projects and create wealth for the Commonwealth. And it's not all egoism and selfishness, though that's obviously present also. But the constructive intent is in that school of thought. And the other side is, of course, as we've heard, to reverse the destruction of nature, to end pollution, stop disruption and the extinction of species, to slow global warming, and to save the Earth from technomania. I love that word, technomania. It's from the early part of last century. And get rid of artificial civilization as if no civilization is not artificial. Well, we can see this all over the place. You can see it in the battles. You remember the spotted owl in the lumber industry, and you remember more recently about the debates on drilling or nuclear power. Or now genetically modified salmon, and whether that should be done or not, or whether you've got to protect the wild fish from the genetically engineered fish if we're going to have them at all. But they're not only causes that people have, these two moral sensitivities that people have, that also covers their interests. So you've got causes and interests that are in debate between these two. But it's also an ideological problem about the relationship, which was mentioned just a few minutes ago, about the nature of humanity to the biophysical universe through technology. Are we in nature or are we over nature? And we are both, but in what proportion? Do we have some balance that needs to be struck or can be struck? Or if we give in to one side too much, is it impossible to fulfill the other side? Now, this debate, modern debate on this topic, is prompted, I think, by a kind of social factor. The industrial technological capacity to control aspects of nature has been enormously compounded in the last two centuries. And if you can do it, why not do it? And if you can get some beneficial results, why, that seems to confirm the right to do it. It's also doubly compounded now by our recession, where there's much less confidence in both the engineering capacities and the economic calculation of its probabilities. And yet, at the same time, because of the joblessness, there's the pressure to grow the economy, enormous pressure, jobs, jobs, jobs. You've heard that, I suppose, in the last few months. And then one way people say you have to grow jobs is to grow them green. Grow green jobs. It's still growth, but that's not what the green advocates want in this case. It's also compounded by a factor that hasn't yet been mentioned. That's the growth of the nation state as the arbiter and promoter of this kind of thing. And that's a political development that means that we've got, whether we want it or not, more centralization of the policies, at least, if not the capitalization possibilities, to either grow green or grow against green. That has enormous political implications. I just thought I'd mention that since we're in Washington. But Nelson's argument is it's not only people's attribution of causes, and it's not only the interests that they have, it's also political ideology. It's holy wars, and there's a religious factor here. And that's what makes this interesting to someone who's a theologian. The people who hold these views, I think they're just and true, and they're people of conviction. And what is a religion? Here's something that Bob and I share, among other things, a definition of religion. It's a comprehensive worldview held by faith in part because you can't prove an ultimate worldview entirely. It's which held to be true and just, by which we ought to interpret reality and do what needs to be done to change reality. So it's interesting in the definition of religion, you have both a descriptive reality and a normative reality, and thinking how what's going on and what ought to be going on, and how do you give warrant to that ought, and whether it has to have a metaphysical anchor or not, or some kind of reference point that's transcendent to the way things are. Now, these two perspectives purport to a legitimacy of their holistic views, which they say are holistic, in both their definition of reality and in their power, allocation of power to make the oughts effective. Notice that there's no definition of God in either one of these kinds of religions that have been sketched out by Bob and also
first name?
Steve. Sorry, Steve. First time I've met him, though I've read him. No mention of God. Now, it's not necessary to have an idea of God in order to be religious. Otherwise, you'd be disqualifying Confucianism, Taoism, and parts of Orthodox Buddhism from this. But you've got to have a sense of transcendence. And that's what's resisted in these particular religions. They are secular religions, and that's a contribution Nelson has made to the vocabulary, a secular religion. We thought we had one in Marx, but it turned out not to be religion at all, just false doctrine. The truth of these secular religions is not based in revelation or in ancient wisdom, as the Eastern religions are. It's the claim is that they are scientifically based, as Bob sketched out for us, about how things work. Science, you see, is value-free. Mm-hmm. Value-free. Well, they make normative judgments that are not value-free. And that's part of the complexity of the two positions that they talk about. That part of his work, by the way, is already evident in the two earlier books that are major writings of his. Reaching for Heaven on Earth, 1991, and a decade later, Economics as Religion from Samuelson to Chicago and Beyond, 2001. And now we have this book about to come out in 2010, a decade later. These two previous books trace the development of these worldviews in the economics profession, but it has presumptions about what policy is and what policy ought to be followed that are not scientific but are religiously held. These are identified as the dominant popular secular religion in Bob's earlier books. In this one, he focuses more on the economic, environmental religion. And he adds this other kind of point, namely that the nation state has become the adjudicator of what religion shall dominate, and that we're tempted to try to develop an established religion, an established secular religion in these modes. At another level, which has already been hinted at by the previous speakers, secular religions are in fact dependent on major motifs of the Christian tradition, Judeo-Christian traditions. They all involve a notion of creation, a fall into sinfulness, a prospect for redemption or salvation, and they all view their own movement as a company of those who can be the agents of redemption. So as the socialists had the idea of the proletariat and the capitalists had the idea of industrialists or bourgeois classes, the environmentalists have the idea of naturalists as this redeeming people. And they are all opposing each other in the economics model and trying to persuade public policy to bend against them the heretical views, otherwise we're going to have hell on earth. So they try to establish a theocratic regime without God. That's a good trick, a theocratic regime without God. But it would be bureaucratized, hierarchical, a new Holy Roman Empire. Bob points out in one place that we had a Reformation, maybe we need a new one. While devotees of the environmental religion oppose the economic faith and criticize the false claims of rationality, progress, and so forth. Another major theme, the Roman Church model did not produce this. This is Protestantism. It's think of Max Weber, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, and he has some hints in something he's written, which he wrote a long time ago, that we have to protect the natural laws. Now, this is engendered by Protestant roots, but these two forms of secular religion borrow from that tradition, but they do not have characteristic teachings that in the sovereign God, providence in spite of sin, and a calling to do God's will in the world. They have that, but it's not God's will, it's natural will, I guess, and agency. But Protestantism's influence in several stages, it's not only the Protestant ethic of capitalism or in technology. Robert Merton, by the way, if you know technological and the Puritans and study of the origins of that. But it also gets traced through the intellectual history, and this is one of the contributions of the volume, the intellectual history from John Calvin through Jonathan Edwards, John Locke, to John Muir. And that's a terribly intriguing chapter, and I think a contribution in itself to understand our American historical legacy. This cluster of ideas now begins to string together, and the different levels, you can begin to see the interaction of the levels. And the book gets especially interesting for a theologian on this. And one of the questions that's been mentioned before, but it has to do with creation and the definitions of creation. By the way, the dispute between the fundamentalist creationists and the new atheists, anti-theology, anti-theists, that's a boring discussion. I can't understand why it gets so much press. If I had to write a book on physics or chemistry at the level of understanding that these authors have of theology, I would be laughed out of the court. It really is not a serious challenge to any serious view. But the idea of creation does have some resonances which are not picked up by either of these secular religions. If you use the word creation, you imply that there's a creator. And that's something rather remarkable, because that means there's a source and a norm for creation, for the biophysical world, that is not part of the natural world itself, but is somehow supranational, natural, is transcendent to the natural. And then you begin to look and see both the possibilities from economic behavior and progress and the possibilities of having reducing the destruction of the environment because the nature is a gift. And then you get the idea that it's not only a gift, but it's a gift to be treasured, and it's an incomplete gift, a faulty gift, because humanity is charged with the duties of having dominion. And by the way, dominion's a very tricky word in theology. It comes from dominus, which means Lord, and it's the way it's used in the "how you shall have dominion" is to treat it the way the Lord God would treat it, with loving care. It's not domination in that ordinary sense of it, of an imperialist attitude toward it. We are charged to develop the culture by tilling the fields and naming the beasts. Naming the beasts means that you have a personal relationship to those creatures, and that you have a capacity also to command them when they're disobedient, the way God commands us. But you've got to command the beasts and the and so forth under the watchful eye of the divine commander. That means you're under norms which you don't make up and don't construct yourself. That's the theological overtones of the using the word creator. Humanity is created, too, with certain gifts, reason and will and affection, the capacities for these. Of course, all of them can be misplaced, and therefore we have sin in manifest in all sorts of ways. You can not only have rationality, but you can have rationalization. You not only have will, you have willfulness. You not only have caring and love and affection, but you can put your loves in the wrong, undesirable objects. And those can be mixed and compounded in various ways. But they give us the capacity to follow something of what is some Calvinist theologians call the cultural mandate, to create cultures that are caring in the way that the Lord cares for humans. Well, the producer of the world sees, without God, nature as a resource for economic religion, as we have heard. And they see technology as made possible essentially by an opposable thumb and a brain that was expanded by additional proteins. They see progress and efficiency as providential, a substitute for providence. It's like the hidden hand of the economists. And it's a reward for obedience, with failure as punishment, fall into poverty. They foresee the innovation that will cure disease, find new sources of energy, bioengineer the whole civilization, geoengineer the globe so it'll stop global warming, and that becomes then a manifestation from a theological standpoint of arrogance and pride, not only giftedness. Well, the preservers see nature as good creation, with sinful humanity violating, raping its beauty, with ecological imperialism bringing apocalyptic possibilities and the end of the world. And we've heard about that a little more from Bob. But this is not all that Bob has argued. This is a glimpse of it, and what he's done is connect the dots between the levels so that one can see that you are dealing with a holistic problem, which even if the parties don't have holistic solutions yet. What shall we make of this contribution? Well, I'm not sure sometimes in the second reading, third reading, whether to rejoice or lament. I rejoice because he's done this expose of the deep roots of the conflicts. That is a contribution to our moral and intellectual history. But I lament there's some unanswered questions, Bob, and I'm going to ask you about this. When you come to your punchline that you're in favor of libertarian environmentalism, well, what does that mean? What is the role of government in libertarian environmentalism? I presume it means freedom, maximum freedom as possible and wise, with grassroots care for the habitat. I'm all in favor of that. Is that all you mean? That could be just a social adjustment that would try to deepen that. But you may have more in mind. And is it possible that that you're wrong about the fact that the Christian and Judeo-Christian traditions are growing increasingly defunct. They may just be covered up, and it may be possible to exhume them and reconstitute them, state them in contemporary terms in a way that is compelling. Do you think they can ever become compelling to a contemporary audience? Or is the game up on that point? And is it possible to have economic progress that is environmentally sensitive? Is there some combination? It seems to me that it would require a larger religious vision than either one of these two secular religions have, and that would be the theological task, and I'm not sure that the present crop of theologians from whom I've just retired are really up to that task. But the task is, the theology works over the generations, and it may be possible to nurture another generation. Well, finally, this is a global issue, many of your examples and many of your treatment are in fact national. Of course, you're working on national policy all the time and have a good excuse for that, but can your answers begin to address the global issues? Because the economic and the ecological don't respect national boundaries anymore, and yet we think still in national boundaries and the power of the nation state, with the power of the nation state itself is compromised by the global developments. So where can we go? Now, I'm willing to wait another decade for your answer. God willing. I want to say again, congratulations. This is a magnificent contribution to all of our thinking.